You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for December 27th, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from the very bottom of Sarah Palin's winter reading list, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
A list?
Yes. And she's checking it twice, baby.
You said it was written on her hand.
On her hand. And it basically consists of Ted Cruz coming over and reading Green Eggs and Ham to her. Over
Along
and over
with
again.
The Christmas sweater, don't
the
forget.
The Christmas sweater. Yeah,
it skips to the end.
It's a holiday classic. You can read that over and over again and never ever figure out who did it. Plus, there's a whole line of children's books coming out of the right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Ted Cruz coloring book and the, yeah.
Rush Limbaugh.
Rush Limbaugh's alternate history.
History of America.
Lord.
Yeah.
I did open that up in the bookstore to find out that American exceptionalism is the theme.
Yes.
You know, that's the whole point.
Mm-hmm. And this is sort of our year-end show. It's not quite the end of the year yet.
Yeah, it's our last show of 2013.
Yeah. Which, according to most people, ourselves included, was kind of a mixed year. We had good times and bad times and ups and downs. But if you listen to conservative radio, as I do occasionally, as I drive all over central Illinois, or if you watch Fox News, and why would you? We're here to suck up those bullets for you. You would learn that 2013 was possibly the worst year in American history, certainly the worst president in American history. And if you read Ron Christie, and again, why wouldn't you?
Why would you?
Ron Christie is the very strange little man who is one of the six or seven black Republicans in America who is professional. He's a professional Republican. He was a consultant. He was one of Dick Cheney's aides. And you see him on television. He's most prominently known for his cross-eyed look.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how you would recognize him from across the crowd.
And we heard from Blagenfreude that he actually knows Chris Christie. Ron Christie kind of personally. Or had interaction with him in an earlier phase of his life. So
Yeah. And Ron Christie, for reasons that, again, passeth all understanding, has a column in the Daily Beast where he has given Barack Obama some brotherly advice about what he should do about how, now that he's screwed the country up so badly. First of all, admit that you're part of the problem. Second, Benghazi, IRS.
Wait a minute. Ron Christie wants Barack Obama
to admit that he's
part of the problem?
Ron Christie doesn't mention the word Republican anywhere, except to mention that I'm a Republican, but I'm interested in America.
Mm-hmm. Both sides.
So I'm interested. I'm not giving this advice. Critics will say I'm just saying these things because I'm a Republican, a paid Republican, but a Republican. But no, I love America so much that I want to tell Barack Obama the first thing he should do is fire all of his most trusted friends and advisors. Then he should apologize for being such a terrible president and admit that he's part of the problem. And then, as far as I can tell, the solution is, of course, Benghazi is in there. IRS is in there. Syria. And finally, I guess, just toss the keys to John Boehner and apologize for ever having been born.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ron Christie. Again, I don't know why he exists at all. I don't know why he has a column in a prominent news thing. I don't know why he thinks it's clever or funny or whatever, but I do know that being Ron Christie, he is always angling for a gig with the next wave of Republican whatever. So,
but you know what? I was thinking, Driftglass, last night, that if I were the first black president,
yeah,
and I gave a speech on income inequality,
mm-hmm.
do you know how much that would gall me to have to do that?
Yeah,
that. Income inequality for the African-American community has been a permanent fixture in the American landscape since the dawn of our nation.
It were built on the free and coerced labor of black people.
Yeah.
Of Aboriginal Americans, of Irish, of especially blacks for centuries.
And that's frankly, it's because income inequality is affecting people like you and me.
Yeah.
That it's a political issue. And Chris Hayes has said, you know, that the revolution will come from those who have the education and the expectation of better than they're getting.
Right.
And that that's where the revolution will come from.
Yeah. When the third tier 10%
right.
gets pissed off at the first
tier 10%.
Tier 1%,
yep.
That's when things will start, and
start to change. Right. And that's when things will start to change.
You know who else says that? George Orwell.
You know who else is a criminal, Drift Class? Jesus.
Jesus. That's right. Orwell makes the point somewhere in 1984, which I got to give to Joy Reid, quoting Edward Snowden.
Yeah, we're going to
basically saying you're quoting 1984 like someone who's never actually read 1984.
Mm-hmm.
Because comparing the U.S., it's worse than 1984, people. It's worse. No, your television doesn't watch you, and no one's trying to outlaw sex, and she goes through this whole laundry list of, you obviously have never read it. It's just a scare word that you use in your incredibly hyperbolic rhetoric.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But in 1984, the problem was never the proles. The problem was never the underclass. They never rebel.
Right.
It's the middle class who overthrows the upper class.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you have to keep them in line. You don't need to surveil poor people. They're of no threat to you at all. So you have to keep the middle tier terrified and part of the program, and that way you can ensure social stability. A fairly cynical, but I also have to say a fairly accurate view of human history.
Yeah. Well, it just occurred to me that Barack Obama having to come out, and not that he shouldn't, and not that we aren't advocating for
right.
less income inequality. We are.
But it has to be him.
But it has, right, that he has to be the one who goes against this, and not for his race. I mean, not for the African-American community that suffered under this forever,
right.
but for people like us.
Yeah. Well, and because that's the Pope's job. Everyone knows that. Man.
The Pope.
Man, the Pope has been just pissing people off.
He's on fire. He's not, well, and I think the Pope would have had a big time face plant if he'd read South Carolina team Rick Santorum's Hanukkah card. Did you hear about this?
No. Tell me.
Well, I can't claim that Rick Santorum actually had anything to do with this, but there is a South Carolina team Rick Santorum already in existence.
This is my shocked face. You can't see it, but this is my
and
this
the is my shocked face. Online, they sent out a Hanukkah card to all of their Hanukkah celebrating friends out there.
Uh-huh.
Which featured a quote from the New Testament.
Oh, really?
Yes.
You sure?
Ye are the light of the world from the Gospel of John, which refers to Jesus, but the idea that it's the Festival of Lights, so let's find a Bible verse that talks about light, and then they chose something about Jesus from the New Testament to put on the Hanukkah card.
You sure it wasn't John from the truck stop?
I thought it was a Photoshop. I thought it was a gag, but it turns out not. And Wonkat would tell me if it was somebody
yes.
made a joke about it. And
you
it
can always trust Wonkat, who turned out to be surprisingly
real.
Not surprisingly.
Not surprisingly.
But we're very apologetic about a certain misunderstanding we had between us about the lineage of a certain Photoshop. So I think we covered that last week, too.
I think we did. I think we did.
They were very nice.
The Pope has reached out to atheists
uh-huh.
and claimed in his one of his Christmas messages that the desire for peace is as valid as a prayer for peace.
Uh-huh.
In other words, leave God out of it.
Uh-huh. Man. Yeah, I saw a few.
And some people think the Pope is an atheist. I don't think that.
No.
I think the Pope. I hope that what's going on is that the Pope simply trusts God to be God.
Yeah.
And is going to work on getting our shit together.
Yeah.
You know, let's work on getting our shit together.
Well,
and
you know, as we have said repeatedly mm-hmm. on this podcast, if you are in favor of decreasing abortions,
mm-hmm.
the best way to do that is public education yep. and contraception.
And educating women.
Educating women. It's absolutely the best way to do that. If you are genuinely interested in this outcome,
yep.
then the best possible way to do that is by lots and lots of education and mm-hmm. the availability of contraception and condoms, especially if you want to cut STDs out too.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, can't we agree? And of course, the answer is no, because it's not about abortion. It's about
power.
My Bible.
It's about power.
But if you start talking to people, and I am old enough to remember conservatives who were sincere in their desire to achieve certain outcomes that didn't involve overthrowing the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, sitting around like having a beer on up on North Sheridan with a friend of mine talking about, you know, if you want the society to look this way, mm-hmm. how do you do that? How do you get there? What's the most efficacious path to that end? And I think the Pope is simply thinking this through and saying, no, I don't want to obsess over the things that divide people. Mm-hmm. I want to focus the church back where I think the church is supposed to focus. I'm not giving up on any of those things. But if I want to achieve a more peaceful world, the best thing to do is work for peace. Mm-hmm. If I want to achieve a more happy and prosperous world in the name
with
of
economic justice, yes,
then I do it this way. Mm-hmm. And the God stuff will take care of itself because I work for, you know, I'm just the regional vice president. You know, the guy at the home office will take care of all that other stuff.
Yeah.
And actually, we had a little interaction with our pastor.
Yes, we did.
About the difference between passivity mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. actively trying to avoid getting in the way of larger benevolent forces that may be at work. Mm-hmm. And I think I cracked him up by saying, oh, it's a Selden crisis.
Yeah, you did crack him up. He knew exactly what you were talking. And then he said, yeah, someone else mentioned, what was it, the two towers or the
Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings stuff. Yeah. Everything's science fiction, it turns out. Yes.
But Lord of the Rings is not science fiction.
Thank you.
You're welcome. But he was doing a good job of telling a historical story, not about the birth of anybody that might, you know, cause anybody in our audience any angst, but an actual siege being laid by two ancient powers against a third.
Ironically, he was talking about the Old Testament.
Yeah,
in
Syria.
His Christmas message. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But it was about alliances and how do you stand up to a greater power than yours and what happens if someone tries to force you into an alliance that you don't want to join. But it was all about this guy being told, do nothing. Quit trying to fix something that doesn't require you to fix it.
Yep.
It's more a matter of trying to understand what your ultimate goal is mm-hmm. rather than and the means will reveal themselves to you. And so if your goal is a more peaceful world, work for economic justice, mm-hmm. work to help the poor. And that doesn't mean you surrender your belief in the rights of zygotes. Mm-hmm. It means that you put them on the back burner because those things will be taken care of mm-hmm. once you take care of peace, prosperity, and economic justice.
Well, let me ask you something then.
Sure.
Based on that, about our own behavior as liberals.
Yeah.
Because I've been doing a lot of introspection this week. Given that it's the first time in many, many months that I've been kid-free.
Yeah, I know.
And thinking about, in terms of our church, because the United Methodist Church is going through a difficult time right now. One branch of the UMC defrocked Frank Schaefer, outrageously, in my opinion, for conducting a marriage ceremony for his son, who is gay. Yeah. They defrocked him for being the minister who married his own son, you know, and most ministers do that if their child is getting married. It's a lovely thing to do. And then Frank Schaefer was then asked to join. They have what are called, I think they're called accepting congregations, who have gone through the process of declaring that they are going to marry gay people and they are going to have same-sex marriage within their parish and accepting people for who they are. Mm-hmm. And they invited him to join that division of, now it's not a division, it's a
cult. It's a cult.
Yeah. No, I can't remember what it is, but it's a bishop within the church. One bishop defrocked him and another bishop also, both of them women, by the way.
There's synods and bishoprics,
yes,
and sees,
exactly,
and all those,
exactly,
weird and Roman.
And one of the West Coast groups asked him to join and become an ordained minister within their conference. I think it's called conference.
Uh-huh.
He also preached at a church in Washington, D.C. on Christmas Eve or the Sunday before Christmas. And that was a welcoming congregation. And they all sang We Shall Overcome and did a thing and did an offering for him and his family. And it just seems as though the church is being dragged in the right direction, but is being dragged. Some of the areas are being dragged.
Yeah.
And I have to think about this in terms of, without getting too personal, our own congregation.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have young people in our attending our church who will not join because we have not gone that far enough in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have actually heard one of the elderly people say, I will leave and walk out if
yep.
they ever marry a gay person to another gay person. And the funny thing is, there are gay people in our congregation.
Sure there are.
They aren't sure saying they are. Anything about it, but... Mm-hmm. Some of them are married to in a straight marriage, and some of them are not, and so all of them are keeping kind of quiet. But that's going on there, and
well, it's going on everywhere.
Everywhere, exactly. And the thought that occurred to me, and you talked about the Selden crisis and do nothing and put things on the back burner.
Not well, and that was a point in distinction. Let me just say, it was not passivity.
No,
it was understanding when to let things play out.
When to let things play out, but I. Got to the point this week in my praying about this situation that I'm coming to the conclusion that it's actually malpractice and sinfulness to claim that the answer is to wait for a generation to die off. That is malpractice against our elders and uh-huh. really not facing the issues that, first of all, it's claiming that we're powerless.
Right.
Secondly, it's malpractice against elderly people, many, many, many of whom are politically liberal, including our parents,
uh-huh.
who, you know, I think we overestimate the Fox News viewership because Fox News has so much money behind it.
That's the thing.
But that then we realize that our battles, as Paul said, are against principalities and powers and not against each other. And we can start talking to one another. And the reason I came to this conclusion is there's actually a program online for churches that want to transition to becoming transition. That's such a wonderful word.
Yeah.
LGBT community, but to transition to a welcoming congregation from a congregation that hasn't faced that issue yet.
Uh-huh.
And the first thing you do is talk to one another.
Sure.
And that can take 2 or 3 years.
Uh-huh.
Where you are, and there's a lot of instruction in this guide to doing this about don't judge, don't argue, don't be nasty, don't let it split your church up. Just talk to one another.
Sounds like the longest Thanksgiving dinner ever. Yeah.
Yeah. But if you stay calm about it, I mean, I'm looking at Utah now.
Yeah, I know. Many people are.
Many people are. And who knew? And of course, the hilarious part of that is that they can't say, well, you know, Utah's always had one man and one woman. For
no. but you can make the flip side of the flip argument that they weren't allowed to become a state until they gave that up.
So they gave that up. And so. maybe there needs to be some understanding that if you don't treat your gay citizens like citizens and give them access to a contract that
is identical to marriage.
It's property rights that is marriage.
Uh-huh.
Because according to the government, marriage is a way of legally recognizing property rights, and it has nothing to do with religion. And those are two different things.
Right.
And people that say marriage is a holy institution have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah. It is an institution that they take to church to be sanctified at their church. But traditional marriage doesn't look anything like marriage in America if you go back
Absolutely.
A few thousand years.
Not even a few thousand years. 500 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
well, as I was cracking wise at our church again, give me that old time religion, but not too old time. Mm-hmm. Because you go back far enough and
then you got to read Aramaic.
Yeah. Well, then you have to read Aramaic and then you have to, you know, sell your children have to be property and then you have to kill people for wearing the wrong clothes and all the other things that Leviticus tells people they have to do to punish the unclean and the abomination of the outsiders, which involve tattoos and crop planting and what clothes you get to wear.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that is sort of filtered out of the conversation because we don't want to talk about that because that's just silly.
Yep.
We just want to talk about the gays because gays are icky.
Yep. And we don't like to think about how they have sex.
Right.
Well, guess what? They don't like to think about how you have sex either.
Right. Nobody likes nobody needs to that. Nobody needs to know about that.
No. But I guess I'm just saying that I would like to recognize that the person that you're speaking to may agree with you more than you think.
Uh-huh.
And I really, truly don't, I guess because he didn't want to cause needless suffering but I really don't understand why Democratic presidents, when faced with a government shutdown, don't say, okay, no Social Security check.
Yeah, well.
That's a government check, and we're broke. We can't afford that. You know, I've been told by John Boehner that we're broke. So we're shutting down the government. We're shutting down the government. You know, and that's all of a sudden you have Congress that are afraid to go home.
If you ascribe to them marginally honorable motives, mm-hmm. for the sake of discussion, for the sake of argument, it's as a liberal, you are charged with defending the weak and powerless, mm-hmm. the elderly and the infirm. And as a conservative, your job is to make liberals choose between constituencies by threatening everybody.
Yeah.
Which one of these are you going to give up? Yeah. Who are you going to sell out? Because we want you gone. We want all of these constituencies wiped out, destroyed, left behind by the government to fend for themselves. They starve. They don't. That's not my problem. They're not my kids. Mm-hmm. They're not my grandparents. They're not my kids. They're not like me. They're not of my tribe. Mm-hmm. And so fuck them. Put them on an ice floe. Let them die. I don't care. It ain't my problem. As a liberal, our job is to say, no, that's not how you run a civilization. It's not how you run a culture. Mm-hmm. You are judged by how you treat these people. You're judged by how you treat prisoners. And conservatives have figured out that you just put the entire economy in a vice and keep squeezing and forcing liberals to make that Sophie's choice. Which do you want to let go? Unemployed people or poor people? Mm-hmm. Who do you want to suffer? The elderly or the sick? The uninsured? And they keep forcing liberals to make these choices that they shouldn't have to make. Mm-hmm. Because the vice that they're squeezing the economy in is deficits they created. And tax cuts, they insist, are good for everyone when they're patently not. Mm-hmm. That's why it's really hard to have that conversation, because the whole predicate of conservatism is false and despicable. Mm-hmm. And no Democratic president is going to stand up and say, or has yet stood up. I mean, Barack Obama's come close a few times, but mm-hmm. not one of them has stood up and said since Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I stood up and said, the problem is bankers.
Yeah.
They hate me because, and I welcome their hatred.
Yeah.
The problem is those people over there hate this country. Mm-hmm. And until those people are driven from office, we're going to continue to have this problem. So your job, my little liberal friends, is to go out and make sure that every place they run for office, there's somebody standing up against them and telling people, if you vote conservative, you're voting to cut the throat of your own country. Mm-hmm. And Democratic Party is nowhere near.
That's true.
Ready, prepared to do that. But there is no other group of people who can mount a national campaign to take the entire conservative movement on nationwide. There just isn't.
Yeah.
There are liberals, and we have loud voices and no money. Mm-hmm. So that's where we always end up. We always end up being forced to choose. And it's always the case with the social service organizations. Everyone I've known, everyone I've worked for, you're able to take care of 5 to 10% of the total population of people who need your services. Mm-hmm. And it need not be so, but you construct your entire organization on the premise that we're only going to be able to help the 10 people in the lifeboat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And conservatives keep saying, let's make the lifeboat smaller. Yeah. Next year, let's make it a little bit smaller. And that's where the biblical discussion comes in, because they fall back on the Bible.
Yeah.
For so much of their justification. Anyway, let's talk about Laurel and Hardy.
I do want you to do a Photoshop of Laurel and Hardy with Chris Christie and Rand Paul.
I
think that's going to be good.
I think that would be delightful.
Because the body type is just right. Mm-hmm. But we had a letter long ago, and we just unearthed it because the author of it sent us delicious cookies.
Yes. Oh, delicious cookies.
Thank you.
Of course we'll read your letter.
Carl, no. Well, I told him at the time that he wrote this, we want to talk about this on the air, and then promptly got busy with other things. But Carl sent us, can I tell him what kind of cookies they were?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
They were from scratch peanut butter cookies with Ghirardelli chocolate chips on top, and then sprinkled with a soupçon of sea salt.
A little butt to make it go wow.
To make it go wow. And they were delicious. They are delicious.
They are delicious.
We have a few left. But he wondered if they were too sophisticated for the children. I said, hell yes, they're out of doubt.
Oh, yeah.
They don't get these. No way. Yeah.
We have a sack of Oreos somewhere.
Yeah.
We can talk. Yeah.
Absolutely. And they're not allowed to have real maple syrup until they can tell the difference between that and Aunt Jemima. So
yeah. Sorry, dude.
Yeah. You don't get to eat this $15 a quart stuff until you can really have the taste buds for it. But he wrote us about silent film comedy, which is his wheelhouse, he says. Uh-huh. And do you want to read this, Laurel and Hardy?
Sure.
Start with Laurel and Hardy. And
we had gotten onto the topic of silent films.
Yes, we had.
And we had somehow gotten away from science fiction. I'd clawed and bitten and scratched, but I couldn't maintain my purchase on science fiction 1 week. And Carl says, and we're going to jump in the middle of the letter, but silent film comedy. Now you're in my wheelhouse, and I can't think of a better subject for a podcast. Laurel and Hardy did not fight each other. The alpha or belligerent Hardy was always in charge, but would put his shoulder to the task with no complaint. The beta or innocent Laurel always knew better when disaster was coming, but as the loyal best friend was powerless to do anything about it. They were capable of ruining things all by themselves, but joined forces against the ill-mannered shopkeepers or cop, Edgar Kennedy, Jim Finlayson, who intruded on their universe. They and Hal Roach created slow, introspective comedy in a cinemascape of near frantic chases and action. By no means did they invent the banana peel on the sidewalk, flower pot perched on the windowsill, or 2x8 teetering on a sawhorse with each man loading either end. But they first gave us the glimpse that knowing what was going to happen could be funny, if we cared about the people it happened to. And they quite easily fit, if not invent, the trope of heterosexual life partners, a non-sexual pair of people who interact and know each other more intimately than anyone else, especially noted in any of the shorts where they had wives. But that's it. It's this wonderful, thoughtful pairing, comedic pairing of the alpha who's not a jerk and the beta who knows better, but his loyalty overrides his common sense.
Yeah.
And that would be a fine way to run a culture.
Your loyalty overruns your common sense. Well, that sounds like the Republican Party.
It's good-hearted.
It's sweet
and it's good-hearted. And the
motive is loyalty to your friend, not self-interest.
And however much you might fight with each other, like an old married couple, when the bad guy comes in, the shopkeeper or the cop, then you join forces to overcome the intruder, the authoritarian who wants to mess up your little world. So nice.
Yeah. And thank you, Carl. And you want to thank we want to thank a lot of listeners this week. Christmas has been amazing.
It has.
We've gotten beautiful Christmas cards, one with a dove, another one that opened like a triptych. Just some really gorgeous Christmas cards full of sentiment and appreciation that just warmed our hearts. Mm-hmm. And we got some books, we got some yarn, we got some cookies, and you wanted to thank Valerie.
Yeah, I want to thank listener Valerie for a big box of fantasy and science fiction magazines, some of which were printed before I was born, some of them have just the last names of the authors. Because everybody's waiting around for the next
timeline. Yeah.
But it coincidentally, Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction was the last magazine from which I scored a personal rejection letter. So thanks for rubbing it in, Valerie.
These are gorgeous. And she sent a rather large box of them and a nice letter that said that her late husband had collected them. And that if her late husband had collected yarn, she'd have sent that. This is what she had. And we're just very grateful to you. Thank you so much. It was fun to watch you, Driftglass, sitting on the sofa looking at these and say,
some of them are from 1958, 1962.
58, yeah, yeah. And they have Heinlein and who else?
Lieber,
yeah.
They don't even bother me. Sturgeon.
Sturgeon, right.
And some of them have essays and some of them have stories I've read. And Valerie asked if the 90-10 rule was in effect. Probably, but Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction has been around a long, long, long time. Mm-hmm. And probably the 90% much of that would have been published in some other magazine.
Yeah.
Because if you're mailing your submissions out, these are the magazines that publish the very high-end writers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hence rejecting me. But and with a very nice personal, and I don't want to slight Gordon Van Gelder, who wrote me a very nice letter, personal letter, saying that he just didn't.
Well, for heaven's sakes, you had a recommendation.
I did. From Harlan Ellison.
Harlan Ellison saying, you ought to read this guy's story.
Harlan Ellison, bless his heart.
Yeah.
Who I'm sure I pissed off last year by calling him during work hours, which I should never do. But took the time to read my story over, give me really, really specific editorial suggestions and questions.
Yeah.
You know, are you sure he would do this as opposed to that? And here's the era, here's the time. Would he have chosen this word? So he read it like an editor.
Yes.
And this is like the greatest gift I've ever gotten from him.
Probably the greatest living science fiction writer there is.
Yes. I would argue strongly that the best thing that J.J. Abrams could do would be to take several $1 million mm-hmm. and ask Harlan Ellison to write the screenplay for the next Star Trek movie, City on the Edge of Forever.
Yep, yep.
And just let him do it, because the Starfleet you've invented is much more in line with the Starfleet he had in mind before Gene Roddenberry decided to mess with the script.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And just let him do it. Just let him have whatever he wants. Give him the biggest movie of his career.
Yep.
But that's not going to happen. Anyway, he went through my story and really nitpicked the way a really good editor does, and then put it in an envelope and sent it with a personal note to Gordon Van Gelder.
Yep.
And Gordon sent me a lovely letter saying, we just don't publish stories like this. It's a fine story. We just don't publish stuff like this. And that, believe me, will sit on my mantelpiece.
Yes.
My favorite rejection letter, along with all of the notes and interlineal notes I got from Harlan Ellison about my short story. So talk about awesome, but it's the same magazine. So they publish the best of the best.
And we weren't going to do science fiction today, but
I'm sorry.
Look what happened.
But the other 90% probably showed up in, you know, Gent and other magazines like that that sort of publish science fiction. Anybody talk about Alec Baldwin and Phil Roberts?
Phil Robertson? Now, that's whiplash.
It is.
I don't want to hear about Phil Robertson, but we consciously did not talk about him last week.
No, and I don't want to talk about him either.
Okay.
I want to talk about Alec Baldwin, Phil Robertson, and Andrew Sullivan walking into a gay bar.
Well, you know, I don't think Phil Robertson ever tried that. Maybe if he tried it, he'd like it.
Well, and all I want to do is point out that Mr. Sullivan has reserved some of his most inflammatory venom for Alec Baldwin.
Yeah.
Who said a really mean thing to a paparazzi that was also gay bashing over his shoulder to the guy who was stalking his family.
Well, and stalking his infant, by the way. This Alec Baldwin's child and wife and child. The child is not 1 year old yet. And they were trying to get the baby into the house.
Yeah.
Into their home. And this, that is not.
This cameraman kept.
Yeah.
And he said, get away from me. Get away from my family. And he backed the guy off.
Yes.
And apparently Andrew Sullivan is completely offended by the fact that he was threatening violence. He was threatening another human being with violence, says the guy who pimped the Iraq war.
He used the FAG word.
Oh, he did.
Yeah.
He did. But it was both homophobic slurs, which I think are inexcusable.
Yeah.
And threatened physical violence. Well, you know, I'm sorry, Andrew, but welcome to Boston and New York.
Yeah.
And if you don't want me threatening violence, stay the fuck away from my kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
baby. Yes.
I'm sorry you don't understand. Again, I remember how prominent you were in promoting the Iraq war. So apparently you do understand using physical violence to achieve an end, or at least threatening it. So that can't be the problem. It really can't be that you're so angry with him threatening to hit somebody that he should lose his job.
Mm-hmm.
And then my point was simply this. Mr. Sullivan is really venomously angry with Alec Baldwin. He's practically the only liberal that Andrew Sullivan acknowledges exists. And his critique of him is always what an awful, despicable, loathsome, disgusting person he is. Liberals are supposed to be better than that, but I guess they're not. Good thing MSNBC fired him. Mr. Duck Dynasty was amusing.
Yeah.
Why is anybody even worried about this? This is why you have reality TV. He's just some redneck and who's put on television, you know, for our amusement. How could you be surprised that he's going to say something like this? And it occurred to me, this has little to do with homophobia or homophobic slurs. This has everything to do with Mr. Sullivan's inbred Tory sense of class privilege.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Alec Baldwin is a peer.
Yeah.
A liberal of the opposing political party, and therefore anything goes. Mm-hmm. Take him down any way you want. Get rid of him. Toss him out. Because he's a member of the upper class to which I consider myself a member or to which I aspire. Phil Robertson is an Aboriginal tribesman brought out of darkest Louisiana for my amusement. His job is to
patronize. I will patronize by not punching down. I will not punch down.
It is very much that British imperial. Yeah. Isn't it amusing what that funny little man said? Now make him go away. And it's that sense of privilege and entitlement that comes through that for Alec Baldwin, inexcusable, fire his ass for something he said over his shoulder in the heat of the moment. This other guy, who's a right-wing conservative fundamentalist who says terrible things about gays and terrible things about African-Americans, Andrew Sullivan excuses because, well, what did you expect?
Mm-hmm.
And that's all about class privilege. And your who do you get to look down your nose at and just be amused by? Because you're never going to meet these people. They're in flyover country. Your life is New York, Washington, D.C., and L.A., and everything in between is just a bunch of hillbillies as far as Andrew Sullivan is concerned.
That's true. Flyover country is.
And therefore, who the fuck cares what this crazy hillbilly said on TV? Why is everybody getting so exercised about it? That's the only point I wanted to make.
Very good.
Thank you.
I just want to mention the hubris of thinking that your Christmas message is equivalent to the Queen's.
Ah!
I'm speaking of Tories.
Yes.
And I don't understand, number one, why it's then about Glenn Greenwald. And
speaking of Whiplash. Yeah.
And I don't understand why having a smartphone means that people are spying on you 24/7 and know your personal thoughts.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing.
able to triangulate your location.
Sure.
But knowing your I thought that really, listening to the Christmas message of Edward Snowden, first of all, that sounds like a Dickens story. And the hubris of it just blows my mind. But the idea that somehow my private thoughts are in my smartphone is interesting.
Well, and this is, I think Lawrence O'Donnell put his finger on it.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much exactly where I stand on this, mm-hmm. Which... no one who thinks I'm an authoritarian obot will believe. But this is an important story.
Mm-hmm.
The NSA has gone way over the line when it comes to surveilling people.
Yep.
They should be reined in.
By Congress.
By Congress. By exposing what's going on internally, that's a great and useful crowbar to force them to act or at least have this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And third... Well,
and there's a difference between surveilling everybody and surveilling someone that a group of you are taking flight instruction and you just came from Yemen... And all of a sudden you're taking flying lessons and having lots and lots of emails back and forth to Afghanistan. And so you get a warrant to find out what these dudes are doing and you spy on them, even if they're in the United States.
Right. And there's a...
Go ahead.
It's somewhat similar to Charlie Pierce's 4-minute rule for listening to Ron Paul, Rand Paul.
Mm-hmm.
For the first few minutes, it makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. And then comes the crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
And... I have nothing but, I'm highly approving, as if that really mattered either way, of digging into the NSA, finding out what they're doing, and bring them under legal control that is transparent enough to know that there's someone out there looking out for our interests.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you put the period there, fine, great, we're all in agreement, that's terrific. But the problem is, they just can't stop talking. So the next thing, and this is why Edward Snowden's Christmas message didn't surprise me. Way back in July, Glenn Greenwald said, the United States has only one goal, destroy privacy and anonymity, not just in the United States, but in the world. That is not hyperbole. That is their objective, to make, now listen carefully, to make every single form of human communication, human interaction, human behavior can never be beyond their reach.
Yeah.
They're in your head, man. They're not. It's not possible for them to be that. But apparently, unless you phrase it in this absolute totalitarian Orwellian nightmare vocabulary, they're afraid that nobody will pay attention to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the problem is, once you've done that, and it turns out that that's not exactly what's happening, you look like you're lying. The problem is that once you've framed the discussion, if you frame the discussion in terms of the NSA is out of control, let's rein them in, how best shall we do that? You're going to get a huge percentage of agreement. Mm-hmm. But if you frame the discussion in terms of the NSA is a wildly out of control Orwellian nightmare that's spying on everything you do, everything you say all the time, and that's its goal, and the United States is a monster nation, and it's worse than 1984, people, then you have a problem. Because once it turns out that isn't really true, you know, once it turns out that whistleblowers aren't all rotting in Supermax prison, once it turns out that your hyperbolic rhetoric, any of it, is simply not true, verifiably, provably not true, then you have a real problem because you end up fighting over the crazy shit that you said to get attention. Mm-hmm. As opposed
now,
to fighting over...
I'm not going to pretend for a moment, though, that whistleblowers were treated fairly over the course of American history. They lose their careers. They lose lots of things.
Exactly.
They do that.
Exactly.
They don't get thrown into supermax prisons, but they do lose their careers, and they are not treated with respect in our society.
And therefore put the period there.
Yep.
Don't then go on to say that... Well, and that's because the U.S. just throws whistleblowers and leakers into supermax hellholes forever.
Yeah, no.
Because that's a lie. Yeah. And once you start doing that, then you have to defend the silly shit you said that turns out not to be true.
And if you actually told the truth, look, the reason Edward Snowden had to flee is because whistleblowers lose their careers, get buried under the... lies of the government,
right,
and are forgotten and had an open platform from which to speak in another country, he might get listened to. And that was his choice, and that's the choice he made. People can judge that for what it is,
right,
and be much more sympathetic to his side of things, I think. I am sympathetic to Snowden from the standpoint of he does have people's attention by doing what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And if he had gone through channels, he wouldn't.
Right. And I'm perfectly willing to accept that.
Yep.
But again, the problem is if you start talking about a dire conspiracy to arrest you the next time you set foot in this country, and you know, at the highest level of government and media, people are talking about arresting me the minute I step off the plane. Well, why isn't Barton Gellman in jail? He's reporting the same story using the same sources you are, and he's walking around a free man. Obviously, arresting reporters is not the default position of the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. If that were true, he would be in jail. So it's the problem is that once you've staked out this very large claim, this over-large, exaggerated, absurd claim about what's really going on, and you're constitutionally unable, your biology does not permit you to ever walk anything back. You just fight and argue and rip into people who question you. You end up looking stupid. Mm-hmm. And then you end up dividing your potential people who are on your side between the people who will believe anything that comes out of your mouth and people who, like, dude, really? Do you have to attack everyone? Do you have to go there every single fucking time? And I, for one, am sick of it.
Drift Glass, do you have a quote of the year? We didn't do a lot of year-end stuff this year.
Oh, yes. My quote of the year?
Uh-huh.
David Brooks is on book leave.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good one. My quote of the year is, I need my paycheck. That's the bottom line. Which was from Republican Congresswoman Elmer from North Carolina, who said that she would not forego her paycheck during the government shutdown.
No, because she needs to get paid.
I need my paycheck. I'm not in that position to give up my paycheck.
Uh-huh.
And it's bubble-headed.
It's those people are not my tribe.
Yep. And other Congress people are my tribe, and they're richer than I am, which is true. She is not the richest woman in Congress. But, yeah, this is my tribe is other Congress people, and I am comparing myself only to them. And everyone else's needs don't matter. Yep.
Uh-huh.
So that's my quote of the year. I need my paycheck. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Everyone needs their paycheck.
Uh-huh. Everyone needs a job.
Everyone needs to. And that's the other thing about this unemployment bullshit of people, the Congress deciding not to extend unemployment benefits. If they had passed one jobs bill this year,
yeah,
I'd have a lot more sympathy for them.
I wouldn't.
But if they had passed one, if they had done anything to address the job situation this year, they might have an argument to be made that they would still lose.
Republic. This is faith-based government.
Yes, it is.
It is Randite Ayn Rand dogma that if you give people anything, you turn them into mooching monsters. You have to fight for everything you have and let the free market decide everything. Rand Paul is never going to say that the economy is broken and it doesn't simply does not generate enough jobs to employ all the people we have. He can't say that. Therefore, he has to say the reason you don't have a job is because you're just living off the fat of the land. You're just swinging in your hammock, loving, you're getting those government sugar, government benefits. And that's why it government benefits have made you too lazy to go out and get a job. Because he cannot say anything other than that, because it's the equivalent of saying Jesus was just this guy.
Yeah, I knew you've said that last week.
Yeah, never did nothing.
I just think there should be a jobs bill.
I do too.
Okay.
I think there should be a. I think there should be a WP
to the choir. I think there should be a CCC.
A WPA and a Civilian Conservation Corps and an infrastructure bank and all those things. But since those are never going to happen,
I wouldn't say never. Never say never.
Since those are not on the immediate horizon.
Exactly, they're not.
Unless you attach them to a bill defunding Obamacare, they're never going to get through the House.
They won't get through the House anyway.
And so the question then is, why are these things so far beyond the pale? Why will they never be considered by this Congress? And the answer is because they govern by faith.
Yep.
They govern by their version of prayer. If you just pray hard enough.
Their version of truth. Yeah. Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is Dodger, and Dodger's a very beautiful kitty for the end of the year. His eyes appear turquoise in this photo, as they are wont to do. We also had an email from Alex about perhaps an Internet Dog of the Year, and Alex's dog has the same name as my nephew, Henry. So I did do a Photoshop of Henry representing the Great Leap Forward in a Chinese propaganda poster. And then Alex and I had a very interesting conversation. They are killing large dogs in Beijing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because large dogs are a perceived threat. And it's causing a lot of problems in Beijing with dog owners who want to keep their large dogs. They're comparing it to the crackdown against Japanese during the World War II. It's just raiding people's homes and taking their dogs away. It's terrible. So Henry is a very large dog in a Chinese propaganda poster. Pro dog. Propaganda poster.
Just like Obama wants to do with your guns, honey.
See? You can send your internet. I will put both Dodger, who is the Internet Kitty of the Week, and Henry's propaganda poster, pro-dog propaganda poster, up at our Facebook page. You can send your Internet Kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. You know we love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email, Facebook message, or U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Unions letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. So, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Oh, Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties are enjoying their last few calm days before Hillary madness takes over the GOP airwaves.
Benghazi!
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast. We're going to end today with a note from a listener via Facebook. David wrote me, and this is a little bit difficult to read, but I think it's important, and I want to prepare people for it. And let me read this letter from David.
Okay.
I want to thank you for your kind words during the darkest time of my life. I don't know why. I just feel a special connection to you and Driftglass. I can tell what warm, caring, and loving people you are just from the podcast. We went to Delaware last week and buried my daughter. I thought that would be the toughest part. It turns out that when it's all over, the friends and family are gone, and I'm left alone with my thoughts. This is the hardest part of all. I just wish that the pain, my guilt, thoughts, and memories would go away. Maybe you could find a minute on your show to ask people to don't be afraid to ask for help. Don't be afraid to approach a friend who seems in need and offer help. If you have time and believe in that, maybe you could for Chelsea and myself. And I lost three people in my family this year. My cousin's daughter passed away in February, and my uncle Russ passed away in November, and my uncle Fritz passed away in December. And it really is exactly the way David mentions it. When the casseroles, dishes are returned, and the funeral's over, and the traveling's done, and everyone's back on, they're in their cars or on their planes to go away, and you're left behind. And I told him, I am not a Stephen minister, but there is this thing called Stephen ministry that is not unique to United Methodists. It's actually a program that transcends denominations. It's lay ministers that are trained to help in situations where a crisis has happened, either a job loss, divorce. Usually it's a spouse passing on, but not always. Loss of a child, pregnancy that ends with the passing of the baby, that kind of crisis happens. Stephen ministers are there to listen. They're there to help in a concrete way. You know, if that means bring food over, if that means bring a blanket, bring a prayer shawl, if that means make sure that the bills are organized. You know, what if there's something like that that's needed, the transitioning, the Stephen minister's there to help with that. Excuse me. And as I say, it's not denominationally based. If you Google Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, like Stephen Colbert, if you Google Stephen ministry, you'll find that it won't be one denomination that has Stephen ministers. It'll be several. But the Stephen ministers always say that they are there when the casserole dishes are returned. You know, that's the point at which they are there to help.
Yeah.
And there is a benign blur that goes on immediately when somebody passes on, where you are just so busy. You're calling people. You're making sure that the funeral home and cemetery are ready. You're dealing with
arrangements.
Arrangements. Lots and lots of arrangements.
Lots of details.
And that is benevolence in a way, that you are that busy because you're in shock. So you have a lot to do, to call people, email people, get the word out, and stuff to do. And that is actually beneficial to the person who's dealing with grief. But then all of a sudden it's gone and it's over. And all those people aren't there anymore, and you've got to deal with your grief. And it's a process, and you have to be really patient with yourself.
And there's no next step.
There's no outline. Right. There's no outline as to where do you go from here. And your loved one is still missing, still gone.
And never to return.
Right. So our thoughts are with you, David. What you're going through is, I hope it helps to know that what you're going through is common.
That we're all wired to respond in the same way.
Exactly. That's what I mean. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. And
so everyone's grief is unique and their experience is their own, but we're all sort of stuck here together, and we all experience these things. Certain moments of our life are universal. And so there are people out there who are trained and really good and professional at helping you cope with things like this.
Yeah. Well, and I went and did a little research about Chelsea, and Chelsea had two young children and a husband and was 31 years old. And I don't have any indication of what happened, but it's a tremendous loss and a tremendous shock when you lose a child. My stepson died when he was 18, and you are not prepared. There's no word for that in our culture, as David's Facebook page pointed out. You know, we know what a widow is. We know what a widower is.
Uh-huh.
We know what an orphan is, because we have words for those things.
Because it's happening in the right order.
Yeah, that's right. But there is no word for a bereaved parent who's lost their child. That there's just no word for that. And there are no words for that kind of loss. So our thoughts are with you, David. And thank you so much for writing to us. Happy New Year, Driftglass.
Happy New Year, Blue Gal.